Dr. Nassau came back to Cleveland and told me, he just said, "Ray, you've got to work for Dow." So I never did any job hunting.
I see. You had never talked to Professor Veazey about Dow at all, either. That's interesting.
I didn't even know the name of Dow. Just it meant nothing to me.
Did you have anything in mind as you were finishing up your master's degree, that what you thought you were going to do?
I don't think I had faced that decision yet. And, of course, the job market wasn't all that promising in the spring of 35. And this came along really kind of early. As I recall, it was could have been March, April.
I see.
And then it turned out that the head of the physical research laboratory at Dow, John J. Grebe, that's the name, you know, was going to get an honorary doctor's degree from Case at the graduation ceremonies in May. And Nassau arranged that I would meet him. Well, he hired me on the spot on the strength of Nassau's recommendation, because we scarcely had time to meet. It was just too busy a period. So I showed up at Case. And went to work on July 5th, 1935.
And you started in the training, student training course.
I went through the student training course.
Could you tell me something about your experiences? I understand there were, it was almost a full year in different...
49 weeks, 7 sessions of 7 weeks each. And so we went around to the different shop departments of Dow, mechanical, the machine shop, the boiler shop, the lead shop, electrical shop, instrumentation. They even had us work in one of the warehouses for pipe fittings and stuff where it ended out, and I had one session, 7 weeks in the physical research laboratory. And of course, I was fascinated by all of this, just because these were new techniques. Of course, we went out in the field with field machinists and repairmen and things like that. We got to see a lot of the plant. I knew the plant inside and out.
Did you have a choice when you finished that student training program, or were you assigned?
I went there with the understanding that I was going to be working for Grebe.
I see.
And I couldn't know it at the time, but Grebe was in disfavor, and he had not followed proper proceedings in hiring me. He wasn't the personnel director who hired people. And so Grebe was in double or triple jeopardy. And all of a sudden I was told that I was going to work over in the X-ray crystallography department. Well, I didn't like that. I finally went to the personnel director and said, I'm not very happy about that assignment. I came here with the understanding I would be working in the physical research laboratory under Grebe. Well, okay, that was arranged. See, I was ideal for this X-ray department because I don't know if you've come across the name of Dr. Hanawalt at all. He was a physicist who was in charge of, he was an X-ray crystallographer, and he made quite a name for himself with the techniques that applied, particularly to the magnesium development and stuff like that. But by going into the physics laboratory, that's where I got exposed to polymers, and of course that just everything followed from that.
You had an early paper on acid solvents for oil wells.
Yeah.
Did you start your work in the PRL right on polymers, or did
no? Of course, Dowell was a big thing. It had developed in the physics laboratory by John Grebe, and they were giving the technical support for Dowell. The first summer, I spent with a physicist who was applying the theories to the flow of oil in underground porous rock to a central gathering place. It was the same as the theory of heat flow and fusion problems and things like that. And so he had me calculating Bessel functions because they were used in interpreting oil flow. That was one of the most boring summers of my life. God. Well, then one of the people in the laboratory, Mr. Chamberlain, had a strong interest in the experimental aspects of the acidizing of underground rock, particularly limestone. And somehow he and I got together and did that work. That was the Chamberlain-Boyer acidizing of oil wells. That's how that came about.
I see.
But the man who had put me on the Bessel functions became interested in polymers. He was a physicist. But there were problems with light and heat stability of both polystyrene and Saran. And he had the idea that all we had to do was to take known stabilizers that were used for rubber, foodstuffs, preservatives generally, antioxidants, and add them to polystyrene, and we'd solve the weathering problem which polystyrene had. And he further had the concept that if we put ultraviolet agents, screening agents, into this polymer and into Saran, that would protect the polymer from UV. So down to the drugstore to buy suntan ointments. And, well, none of those things worked. So we had to branch out on our own. And the organic laboratory under Edgar C. Britton, and that's a name that you know.
Yes.
sent samples of every chemical it synthesized over to the biochemical laboratory. And that biochemical laboratory under D.D. Irish, I don't know if you've run into that, was located also in the physics lab. And all those chemicals came over from the Britain lab to the biochem lab, and they were stored upstairs on the second floor of the physical research laboratory. Well, that was became our hunting ground. Hundreds and hundreds of chemicals, many of them absolutely new, not even available from Eastman Kodak or anything like that. And we began trying those out, and we began striking pay dirt. Now, there's where I learned organic chemistry. We were screening hundreds of organic compounds, and I just somehow absorbed, because I was interested in structure performance relationships. And I learned also which chemical groups were chromophores because of the ultraviolet screening. So that was my course in organic chemistry. But anyway, then it turned out that Britain was convinced that any compound that he and his group synthesized in the organic laboratory should, if that compound turned out to be useful and patentable, have either his name or one of his men's name on the patent. And he began raising hell that we were stealing his compounds there behind his back without his permission, using them and applying for patents on them. And he tried to block the leakage. Well, we compromised, and some of his people's names got on our patents. And all they had done is synthesize the compound, no conception that it might be useful for such and such and so on. But anyway, that was...
Did Grebe and Britain get along pretty well? Or did they have any cooperative relationship?
Philosophically, they were North Pole and South Pole. Britain was the cut-and-dried, methodical organic chemist, and damn good. And Grebe was the creative guy who sparked and didn't want his name on patents. Britain ended up with, well, I forgot, 350 patents. And, Britain.
Mm-hmm.
And Grebe ended up with 50 patents. But Grebe made for Dow 100 times the profit over the years that Britain did. So, yes, they were competitors.
I want to come back to that competition later on.
Okay.
There's some other aspects
all
of
right.
that, too, when we get into the styrene era that we want to talk about. 1936, there was an accident in the carbon bisulfide plant.
I don't know how you know about it.
It's in that, there's just a mention of it in the Dow History of the Research Lab.
Oh, yeah.
A brief mention of it.
Yeah.
Is there any more details? What was, were you involved in making carbon bisulfide at that time?
Well.
It was 1936, I believe.
one of the big... there were two processes for carbon disulfide at Dow. One was the use of steel pots that were fired underneath a gas and oil. They might have a capacity of 100 gallons or something. And into the top of those pots containing molten sulfur, workmen would dump charcoal, and out would come carbon disulfide. And they had a building, it must have been 100 feet long, with maybe 30 of those pots in it. The stink was unbelievable. Blue flames shooting out, leaks in those pots, and so on. And at one point, we had to go through that building when I was still in the training course. And I always considered that an example of what hell would be like. The smell of hot sulfur, burning sulfur, and the flames and the heat and everything. Dow had a newer process, which was a big steel vessel electrically heated through three electrodes, three phase, huge carbon rods, and into that big vessel went the charcoal, and being electrically conducting, well, that got hot, and sulfur was run into that from one of these pots again, vaporizing the sulfur. Now, this furnace was very inefficient electrically because of eddy currents in the steel shell of the big container. I've forgotten the power factor, maybe 2/3, something like that. So the physics lab had a project of trying to improve the electrical efficiency of that carbon disulfide furnace. And my boss had the idea that if we put stainless steel plates instead of steel around each of the three electrodes, it would improve the electrical efficiency. And that was done. But he still had the problem from the physics lab. This is Dr. Matheson, who was a physicist, and I was, I hadn't mentioned his name before, but M-A-T-H-E-S-O-N, first name Lorne, L-O-R-N-E, Canadian. I guess it was in the student training course that when I was in the physics lab, he was working on making electrical measurements on that furnace to check out power factors, efficiencies, and so on. And while we were in the building, the pot that vaporized the sulfur sprung a leak and put sulfur vapor out into the whole volume of that building, and it caught fire and exploded. And I got burned. Another fellow, coworker, also got burned. One of these, I don't know, chance in a million things, because it wasn't our normal place of work, and we weren't there very much, but it happened. And well, I got treated in the Dow first aid. It turns out the burns were not serious. But it did happen.
How much longer did that did the older process continue, or did they move to the newer process then?
I used to have a scar. Still have a scar from the burn, but it's gradually... I don't remember. Eventually, those pots were phased out, and then eventually, somewhere along the line, Dow got out of the carbamide sulfide business. I never had any more to do with it after that summer of that spring of 36.
In the let me go to some of your wartime experiences. A number of things here that I wanted to ask you about in terms of the papers you published. Let me take them in order. You, with Heidenreich, had a paper on automatic heat distortion recorder for plastics that then became an ASTM method.
Not Heidenreich, Hirholzer.
Okay.
It better be Hirholzer. Is it?
We can check it later. I have down Heidenreich. So.
H-I-E-R-H-O-L-Z-E-R. Heidenreich ran an electron microscope. Hirholzer worked for me as an instrument technician. Yeah, so he built that instrument.
What was the rationale behind that? What was the need for doing that?
Well, heat distortion tests were one of the common characterization tools for thermoplastic polymers. Where did they soften? And so there was an ASTM test, and it consisted of a little strip of the polymer. It was mostly polystyrene at that time in the physics lab, resting between two supports with a weight in the middle, and a micrometer to read the displacement of the top of the weight, the deformation. And this was tedious hand stuff that you assigned to technicians. And maybe they were paying attention, maybe they weren't. Now, one of Grebe's big contributions to Dow Chemical was automation. He and Bounty devised the first automatic controllers that were ever used at Dow for process control. So one of his strong philosophies was that automate. That was a characteristic theme of the physics lab. So here was a, why not automate the heat distortion recorder? And so all it took was an electrical sensing device. I've forgotten now. I couldn't tell you the exact principle, but that's what we did.
I see.
And we published it, and it was eventually adopted by ASTM because it was more accurate and foolproof and automatic.
Well, let me go to a different paper. Maybe I'll be correct with Heidenreich this time.
Yeah, you can.
Technique for direct observation of the polychlorostyrene single molecule.
Yeah.
One of the first times that was done?
Yes. To my knowledge, that was a first. Now, things like tobacco mosaic virus had been seen before. Mm-hmm. In the electron microscope. They were multi-million molecular weight. And they were crystalline, of course. So, the concept of this was my own, because Heidenreich simply operated the electron microscope. Exceedingly good at it. So good that he got hired by Bell Labs, stole away from us, Dow eventually. But I had learned by that time enough theory about Palmer solutions to realize that if you got down sufficiently dilute, you ought to have individual Palmer molecules. And I also knew that if one added a non-solvent to a solution of polystyrene, you'd precipitate the polymer out, and you could collect it. So the key idea then was to get down to a dilution which would have individual polymer chains floating around in the system, and then to add a non-solvent to try to capture them as individual molecules. And we went to coarse styrene to get more electron density to make them more visible in the microscope. And so that was the basic idea. And, well, that thing has been copied all over the world, and Boyer's forgotten. You know, he just... Techniques got refined tremendously, shadowing in particular. And what's your background, by the way?
Physical chemistry.
From where?
Photochemistry. I got my degree at Northeastern. In Boston.
Boston, yeah. My son got a PhD degree there.
Really?
In atomic physics. Oh. Yeah. Much, much later. Well, probably not all that much later.
You and McIntyre, going back to the early 40s now, did some work in modifying polystyrene with natural rubber.
Yeah.
In that time. Did you say something about that work?
Well, yes. When radar got developed in England, electrical cables were needed which had low electrical loss and could be used to transmit these high frequency, then very high frequency, signals through cables from, say, the antenna dish to receivers, amplifiers, and so on. And, well, rubber seemed to meet the electrical needs, natural rubber, and the flexibility, but these cables were frequently used in very warm places, and the central conductor, the cable was under flexure frequently, going around corners and so on, and the central cable that carried the signal would tend to displace toward... There was a copper braid outer shell on those cables. It acted as a shield, and as electrical shield and a return conductor. And so the idea started early on to modify rubber with polystyrene, which was an even better, well, it was good electrical material to have low dielectric loss. And this thing started, as I recall, in England. And Dow got approached to help out in this venture because we were then Mr. Polystyrene already in the United States. And that was the start of that venture.